Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Lee Buckley, your guide, and today we're embarking on an in-depth exploration of the October 2025 issue of National Review. This isn't just a collection of articles, it's really a window into some of the most pressing national and international topics. It forces us to reconsider long-held assumptions and, well, challenges conventional wisdom at almost every turn.
And I'm Jordan Chambers, thrilled to join you on this journey. This particular October issue, it's really a masterclass in covering a vast and intricate range of subjects, you know, from the deep dives into education reform and significant geopolitical shifts to a close look at economic policy and, yeah, a few surprising cultural observations. It truly offers a fascinating lens through which to view the conservative perspective on the critical debates of our time. Our mission, as always, is to navigate these pages, extract the crucial insights, and help you understand what truly matters in, well, let's face it, a complex world.
Okay, let's dive headfirst into what I think is a truly essential section in this issue, an education reset. National Review has dedicated a special focus here to rethinking and reforming American education. And frankly, the timing couldn't be more critical. The backdrop for this proposed reset is, to put it mildly, quite grim, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. Grim is one word for it.
We're talking about a decade-long decline in reading and math achievement. The most recent National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NAEP scores, they show fourth grade reading outcomes at a 20-year low, 40% of students scoring below basic proficiency. That's staggering.
Yeah.
Eighth grade reading scores hit a historic low, too, 33% below basic. And beyond academics, chronic absenteeism is way up, and you hear about grade inflation, pervasive misbehavior. It's clear the status quo just isn't working.
Right. The statistics are indeed stark. It really paints a picture of an educational system in, well, distress. But what makes this special section particularly compelling, I think, is that it doesn't just dwell on these problems. Instead, it actively investigates and presents potential solutions. And here's where it gets really interesting. Some of these solutions are emerging from what you might call unexpected corners, challenging some deeply entrenched beliefs about what actually works in education.
Unexpected corners.
Yeah. We're going to explore some contrasting approaches that are demonstrating surprising success, yet for various reasons, they seem to remain largely under the radar of the wider educational establishment. It's a genuine disruption to conventional wisdom.
So let's jump right into the first article in this section. It's titled The Southern Surge: What Four States Can Teach the Country, by Frederick M. Hess. This piece shines a light on a truly remarkable academic recovery unfolding in Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee post-2019. The Harvard-Stanford Education Recovery Scorecard has been meticulously tracking these states, and the results are, as the article puts it, eye-popping.
Eye-popping is right.
Alabama was first in math recovery, third in reading. Louisiana, second in math, first in reading. Mississippi, sixth in math, fourth in reading. And Tennessee, third in math, ninth in reading.
Pretty impressive rankings across the board.
But the real Mississippi miracle that Hess points out is almost unbelievable. Black students there now rank third nationally. Its low-income kids actually outperform those in every other state.
Every other state, wow.
Yeah. And Mississippi is the only state to see gains across all performance levels over the last decade. The average went up, sure, but so did the scores of its highest and lowest performers. That's not just improvement. That's like the whole system elevating everyone.
It is. And the article really dives into the core drivers behind these remarkable results. It offers a blueprint, really, that challenges the idea that reform has to be inherently complex. A major factor seems to be a steadfast, almost old-fashioned commitment to basic skills, particularly phonics-based early literacy instruction.
Phonics, right.
Mississippi, for example, implemented its 2013 Literacy-Based Promotion Act. This was under former state superintendent Carrie Wright. This act fully embraced phonics, you know, teaching reading by focusing on the relationship between letters and sounds. It mandated comprehensive literacy training for teachers and even required holding back struggling third graders.
Holding them back? That sounds controversial.
Well, the article frames it not as punishment, but as a critical intervention.
Okay.
They also set up intensive summer reading camps. Alabama did something similar with its 2019 Literacy Act, providing 60 hours of focused instruction to low-performing students. Get this. Last year, apparently half of the 30,000 students who attended caught up to grade level.
Half. That's huge.
Huge. And Louisiana has taken a similar aggressive stance. They explicitly banned the problematic three cueing systems.
Ah, the guessing method.
Exactly. Where kids guess words based on context or pictures instead of sounding them out. Instead, they're implementing knowledge-rich programs like Bayou Bridges, which knits together history, geography, civics, economics, a coherent curriculum. These states are focusing on rigorous materials, robust teacher training, and it's all underpinned by a clear system of accountability.
You know, what's truly an inconvenient lesson from this Southern surge, as Hess calls it, is the stark contrast in how these states responded to COVID. These Southern states largely prioritized reopening schools for in-person instruction. By September 2020, most schools in Mississippi and Tennessee were open. Half of Louisiana's schools, too.
Right.
You might remember Louisiana schools chief Cade Brumley dramatically walking out of that legislative meeting saying, "If you're going to keep schools closed, you're going to do it without me."
I do remember that. A strong statement.
It really stands in sharp relief against many blue state schools,
mm-hmm.
which stayed tightly shuttered for much longer, you know, opting for remote learning. It really forces you to consider the long-term impact, maybe still unfolding, of these very different policy decisions on student learning and well-being.
Absolutely. Was the disruption from the closures a greater detriment than the health risks? That's the question.
The data from these states certainly suggests a significant educational cost to those prolonged closures.
And that brings us to a crucial question the article raises. Why does this Southern surge remain largely unfamiliar to so many people, especially within the education establishment? Hess points to several factors, potent ones.
Okay, like what?
For one, he says the approach isn't sexy. It's about basic skills, hard work, rigorous instruction that doesn't generate splashy headlines or, you know, trendy conferences.
Right, not the latest buzzword.
Exactly. There's also what the article calls an unacceptable form of prejudice, a deep-seated contempt for red states, for the Deep South. The idea that policymakers there are actually fighting for poor kids or taking the science of learning seriously just doesn't compute for, let's say, cosmopolitan progressives or the education professors. It challenges their preconceived notions.
That's a strong claim.
It is. And furthermore, and this is a massive point, it directly undercuts the more money narrative in education.
Ah, the funding argument.
Precisely. These Southern states spend significantly less per pupil than states like Illinois, Massachusetts, California, or New York. Much less. Yet they are showing demonstrably better results.
So for people absolutely convinced that school improvement always requires more funding.
This Southern surge is, as the article dryly puts it, unhelpful.
Unhelpful. Yeah, I can see that. That's a powerful and a deeply disruptive point. The core undeniable insight from this Southern surge seems to be that effective education boils down to, well, the fundamentals, stupid. A disciplined focus on basic skills, rigorous instruction.
Cutting through decades of fads.
Right. And demonstrating that effective reform isn't solely dependent on just throwing more money at the problem. Which brings us to the practical lessons from this success for parents, educators, public officials.
Mm-hmm.
First, Hess emphasizes, it's the fundamentals, stupid. Education, he argues, has been highly vulnerable to fads, quick fixes that prioritize abstract concepts over foundational knowledge.
Right, things like global citizenship or self-guided learning.
Exactly. What works, he says, are simple solutions relying on discipline, rigor, demanding expectations, hard work. Second, curriculum matters. Deeply. The article points out that too often teachers are left to kind of make up their own lesson plans.
Pulling stuff from Pinterest or Teachers Pay Teachers.
Right. And this DIY lesson planning can lead to problematic materials sneaking in, like the controversial 1619 project, even without official adoption.
Whereas these Southern states are actively curating and supporting quality substantive materials.
And third, strong school leadership. It needs to be coherent and sustained, avoiding that whiplash and fad chasing that you see in so many reform efforts.
Which is just a lousy recipe for school improvement, as he puts it.
Exactly.
And the article also highlights what it calls an appealing model of professionalism offered in these states. Louisiana's Let Teachers Teach agenda, for example. This program was apparently devised with direct input from respected Louisiana teachers, and it addresses their core needs.
How so?
By allowing ungovernable students to be placed at alternative sites crucial for classroom order, abolishing antiquated lesson planning requirements, reducing the burden of mandated teacher trainings that often feel like, you know, administrative busy work.
So it actually empowers teachers.
It genuinely empowers them by addressing unruly students, reducing bureaucracy, streamlining training. It helps them focus on teaching, not managing chaos or jumping through administrative hoops.
That builds trust, I imagine.
builds trust, the article notes, and directly drives school improvement. What's clear is that when teachers feel valued and supported in their core mission, real change happens. And that leads us to a fascinating question. Who is truly championing teachers in this shifting political landscape? And can conservatives actually win them over? #ShagShag How Conservatives Can Win Over Teachers by Daniel Buck and Will Flanders.
Okay, this next piece, How Conservatives Can Win Over Teachers by Daniel Buck and Will Flanders, it follows perfectly from that last point. It posits an incredible opportunity, conservative policymakers potentially winning over teachers. And it draws this fascinating parallel to the Teamsters Union, which showed its members leaning heavily towards Trump in a recent internal survey.
Right.
It suggests that the cozy long-term relationship between unions and the Democratic Party might be cooling. And a similar dynamic could be at play with teachers, who are often just painted as this monolithic left-leaning bloc.
Indeed. And the authors present some compelling survey data that really challenges that monolithic perception. Sure, it's true most political donations from teachers still lean Democratic, but surveys show surprising political moderation among teachers themselves.
Moderation. How so?
Well, an Education Week survey found 43% identify as moderate. Even more astonishing, before the latest presidential election, 39% of all teachers, and get this, a full 49% of Gen Z and millennial teachers, so those aged 22-44, intended to vote for Donald Trump.
Wow, nearly half of the younger teachers. That is significant given the traditional union alignment.
It really is. The article suggests there's a fundamental disconnect between the, let's say, progressive stances of union leadership. Things like anti-Israel resolutions, promoting BDS, that's the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement against Israel LGBT book lists, messaging challenging two genders,
okay,
and the more normal or conventional views of their members, who often believe in concepts like two genders and that America is, broadly speaking, a great country. This ideological gap, they argue, creates a significant opening.
And it makes perfect sense when you consider what teachers are actually concerned about in their day-to-day professional lives. The article highlights that student behavior and classroom disruption, that tops the list of teacher stressors.
More than pay.
Even outranking concerns about pay and administration, that's a crucial insight, often missed by policymakers who are, you know, far removed from the classroom.
Absolutely.
Teachers are on the front lines, dealing with the pandemonium of discipline structures that are often too soft on consequences. They're left with little power to maintain order.
Right.
The unrelenting chaos, as the authors put it, that's what truly makes their lives miserable, far more than salary or paperwork. It's that constant battle for control and respect in their own classrooms.
That's precisely it. The core insight here is that teachers are often caught between union leadership's progressive agenda and the really challenging realities of their classrooms. And this creates an opportunity for conservative policies to directly address their primary stressors. Well, the article argues that unions have, maybe ironically, made teachers' lives harder by advocating for lenient discipline policies and pushing ideologically suspect curricula. These actions often sort of deputize teachers into these quasi-therapeutic roles, redirecting their purpose away from what they actually want to do. Teach core subjects, math, science, history, literature.
Right. They signed up to teach, not be therapists or social workers necessarily.
Exactly. And the unions, the article claims, aren't advocating for policies that meaningfully improve the teaching profession in the ways teachers actually want, despite automatically deducting dues from their paychecks. This creates a significant opening for conservatives to step in, not by being anti-teacher, but by being pro-teacher in a really practical, classroom-focused way.
So the authors propose a clear strategy for conservatives to, quote, sever the connection between teachers and unions and ultimately win them over. A key part of this is advocating for stricter discipline.
Makes sense, given the stressor point.
Yeah, and we're already seeing this with these teachers' bills of rights passed in states like Texas, Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, Tennessee, South Carolina. These empower teachers to maintain order, remove unruly students without fear of reprisal.
Mm.
West Virginia has clarified responses to violent students. Nevada repealed restorative justice requirements, which often prioritize mediation over consequences, sometimes leading to repeat offenses.
Okay.
The article calls championing discipline the educational equivalent of immigration restrictionism for other labor unions, meaning it's a top priority for members who feel their leadership isn't addressing their fundamental workplace safety and effectiveness concerns.
That's a potent analogy. Another critical policy move they suggest is expanded access to liability insurance and legal representation for teachers.
The protection aspect.
Exactly. The article points out that unions often use this powerful scare tactic to recruit members. Join the union or stand alone when a student inevitably falsely accuses you of misconduct.
Right. That's a compelling reason to join.
It often is. And this legal protection might be one of the few real benefits unions provide, as some research suggests they don't significantly increase teacher pay. So, by strengthening state-level protections or mandating that districts inform teachers of alternative professional organizations, like the Association of American Educators, which offer similar protections at a fraction of the cost.
States could effectively undercut a primary practical reason teachers join unions in the first place.
Precisely. The goal here isn't necessarily union busting through legislation, but rather creating an environment where enough teachers choose to leave so that union influence diminishes naturally, aligning with teacher priorities, not a progressive political agenda.
And beyond discipline and legal protections, the article suggests other policy moves conservatives could make to genuinely champion teachers.
Such as?
Professional development that focuses on practical skills, classroom management, instructional delivery rather than useless theory or progressive virtue signaling that teachers often find irrelevant.
Yeah, practical stuff they can actually use.
Streamlining licensing requirements, which can be a real nuisance and financial burden for young teachers or even for veterans. And crucially, providing quality, substantive curriculum. Things like core knowledge or wit and wisdom.
Freeing them up from lesson planning.
Exactly. Freeing them up from spending countless hours crafting their own materials or buying them from places like Teachers Pay Teachers. Letting them focus on teaching, not curriculum development.
The potential impact of such a shift in allegiance is, well, it's profound. The article highlights that currently 70% of union-endorsed candidates win local school board elections. That gives unions immense power over policy and curriculum.
70%. Wow.
Yeah. If conservatives could tip that balance to even 50-50, the consequences would be far-reaching. Imagine school boards excising woke curricula with a finer-tooth comb, restoring order to classrooms, redirecting schools to their core focus on academics, math, science, history, literature. This, the authors contend, could remake and recapture American education more profoundly than any executive order ever could, working from the ground up.
That focus on empowering teachers, it naturally extends to another critical stakeholder, parents.
Right.
Their evolving role in education is the subject of our next piece, demonstrating how these internal school dynamics are kind of intertwining with broader parental rights movements. #, the expanding power of parental rights by Nicole Stell Garnett.
Jordan, let's now transition to The Expanding Power of Parental Rights by Nicole Stell Garnett. This article opens by reminding us of the historical precedent set, a century ago, with the Supreme Court's landmark Pierce v. Society of Sisters decision, 1925.
Pierce, right. Foundational case.
It established parents' fundamental right to direct their children's upbringing and education, even outside public schools. The court famously stated that the child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with the high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations.
A powerful statement. It really recognized the primary role of parents.
And in the century since Pierce, the K-12 education landscape has transformed dramatically, giving practical meaning to those rights.
Oh, absolutely. In 1925, your public option was basically just the geographically assigned school down the street. Now, parents can choose from magnet schools, charter schools, intra and inter-district choice policies, much broader public options.
And private options too, right?
Crucially, yes. In many states, they can access parental choice devices. Things like vouchers and education savings accounts, or ESAs. These let them use public education funds for private schools or homeschooling. This evolution really expands the practical application of those original parental rights, providing actual avenues for parents to act on their preferences.
The article then hones in on a truly landmark event that has just occurred. The Supreme Court's June 27, 2025, decision in Mahmoud v. Taylor.
Yes, the Montgomery County case.
Exactly. This case reversed lower court rulings regarding that county's LGBTQ+ storybook mandate. Remember, they had eliminated parental notice or opt-out options for these books in K-5?
Right, no opt-out.
This was a massive victory for parents. The Supreme Court basically said public schools can't force feed a particular ideological viewpoint on sensitive topics to young kids if it clashes with parental religious freedom, especially without an opt-out.
It was indeed a pivotal decision. And the court's reasoning in Mahmoud v. Taylor is critical for understanding the new landscape of parental rights within public schools. Justice Alito, writing for the majority, emphasized that the parents objected to content that went beyond just exposure to objectionable ideas.
Okay, what did it do then?
It unmistakably conveyed a particular viewpoint about same-sex marriage and gender. And furthermore, the school board had specifically encouraged teachers to reinforce this viewpoint and to reprimand any children who disagree.
Wow, so active reinforcement.
Active reinforcement. The court found that this mere exposure was indeed a constitutionally cognizable burden on religious freedom. And crucially, the court rejected the argument that religious liberty was adequately protected only by the right to educate kids in private schools.
Why is that crucial?
Because it acknowledged that many parents have no choice but to send their children to a public school due to financial and other constraints. So, in plain terms, the Supreme Court told public schools they can't force kids to adopt specific ideological viewpoints on sensitive topics, especially if it clashes with parental religious beliefs.
Right.
And parents don't just have to leave public school to protect their rights.
Okay.
This decision ensures that the right of parents to direct the religious upbringing of their children follows them into the public school classroom.
That's a powerful and nuanced distinction. The core insight from Mahmoud v. Taylor is that parental religious liberty doesn't end the public school door. Mere exposure to ideologically charged content that clashes with parental beliefs can be a constitutional burden, giving parents who choose public schooling far greater leverage.
Exactly. Which leads to the article differentiating between two fundamental ways parents exercise their rights: voice and exit.
Voice and exit. Explain that.
Voice, now significantly strengthened and protected by Mahmoud, involves demanding accommodations within public schools, asking for different curricula, opt-outs, policy changes.
Making your voice heard inside the system.
Right. Exit, protected by Pierce and greatly expanded by state legislation, means choosing alternative educational options, private schools, homeschooling, charter schools.
Leaving the system.
Yes. It's a crucial framework for understanding the evolving battle for parental control over education. It highlights that inevitable conflict between the state schooling's goal to, maybe, standardize children, expose them to ideals public educators deem necessary for good citizens, and the constitutional commitment to religious liberty. Especially, as the article notes, when those public educators' ideals are often left-leaning and clash with parents' religious objections.
Okay, so Mahmoud is a big win for voice.
A significant win. But the article also carefully analyzes its limits. It doesn't require public schools to accommodate all religious objections, and it certainly doesn't mandate public funding for private school choice on free exercise grounds.
So it doesn't open the floodgates entirely?
Not necessarily. The current Supreme Court, largely composed of formalist or originalist justices, meaning they interpret the Constitution based on its original text and meaning, not evolving standards, they're likely skeptical of arguments pushing the Constitution that far.
But
the article highlights the good news: the rapid legislative expansion of parental choice options. This is a victory forged in the courts of public opinion and state legislatures, not the judicial ones.
So the political route is working.
It seems so. Currently, 34 states have at least one program empowering parents to send kids to private schools at public expense. 18 of these extend eligibility to all children.
All children. Universal choice in 18 states.
That's what it says. Over 50% of American children are now eligible for a private school choice program. And we're even seeing the first federal private school choice program, a tax credit for scholarships, included in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, targeting 2027 for all states. It signals a real national shift.
Okay, so if we connect this to the bigger picture, how does the Mahmoud decision empower parents who choose to keep their kids in public schools? And what are the broader political and social implications of these voice and exit strategies kind of converging and expanding at the same time?
Well, Mahmoud significantly strengthens the hand of parents in public schools because it validates that idea that mere exposure can be a burden. It gives them legal recourse beyond just pulling their kids out.
Right, more leverage internally.
Exactly. Politically, the convergence of voice and exit means parental rights movements gain strength from both sides. When parents feel they can't make their voices heard within schools, they push harder for exit options like ESAs.
And the expansion of exit options.
In turn, pressures public schools to be more responsive to voice demands because they fear an exodus of students and, well, funding.
Ah, a feedback loop.
Sort of. Socially, it's likely to intensify the cultural battles over school curricula, forcing a clearer line between core academic construction and ideological advocacy. It highlights a growing recognition that education isn't just about test scores, but deeply intertwined with family values, religious beliefs, making public education a more contested, maybe more diverse landscape.
This shift in education, this reevaluation of fundamental assumptions, it's just one of many shifting sands this issue of National Review covers.
Absolutely.
Which moves us neatly into our next segment on economics and geopolitics.
All right, let's shift gears now to economics and geopolitics. We'll start with a really fascinating piece by Dominic Pino titled The Hidden Damage from Tariffs. Now, we've all heard the basic economic theory, right? Tariffs distort markets, raise prices, reduce output. That's pretty well established.
It's like Gun 101, basically.
Right. But Pino goes beyond that. He details the non-market damages that are, frankly, much more insidious and widespread, revealing how tariffs can become a tool for political influence.
And what's fascinating here is how Pino illustrates that tariffs, far from being just a simple economic tool, actively feed the swamp in Washington.
Feed the swamp? How?
The article reveals a massive surge in tariff lobbying. Spending jumped from $1.3 million to $8.8 million in just one quarter.
Wow, that's a huge jump.
Huge. This massive increase in influence peddling directly benefits large businesses, those with deep political connections. Often through donations to Republicans or, you know, revolving door lobbyists securing exemptions,
yeah.
It essentially creates a system where companies that can afford to pay lobbyists hundreds of thousands can potentially make multi-million dollar tax expenses just disappear.
Which leaves small businesses out in the cold.
Exactly. It disproportionately harms small businesses that just can't compete in that lobbying game, creates an uneven playing field where political access trumped economic efficiency.
That's a critical point about small businesses. Pino gives a really compelling example. Isco Loudspeakers. It's a Minnesota-based manufacturing company, founded in 1949, exports to Canada.
Okay.
To build its speakers, Isco imports some components from China. Now, because of tariffs on those imported parts, it's actually become more cost-effective for Isco to contract with a factory in China to build the entire speaker and ship it directly from there to Canada.
Wait, so the policy designed to bring manufacturing back is causing them to offshore the whole thing?
Precisely. So what was explicitly supposed to be a reshoring policy is actually causing offshoring in this case, a complete reversal.
A classic unintended consequence.
Exactly. And this administrative burden, the article notes, disproportionately harms smaller companies, forces them to rely more on customs brokers whose fees are rising because it's all getting more complex.
And then there's the profound constitutional challenge. The article highlights that Trump's tariffs, imposed under an emergency powers law over the trade deficit, have been ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Court of International Trade, unanimous decision, Supreme Court ruling still pending.
Unconstitutional, why?
The critical point is that never before in American history has a national emergency been declared over a national accounting statistic like a trade deficit. Taxing imports is an enumerated power of Congress. It's explicitly given to Congress in the Constitution. It generally can't just be delegated to the executive branch without clear legislated limits.
But Trump claims.
Trump, however, claims unlimited tariff authority, that he can set them for any country, any rate, any period, modify them at will. This is a profound legal challenge to the separation of powers, the very scope of executive authority.
And the implications of that claim go far beyond just trade, don't they? The core insight here seems to be that tariffs, under the guise of economic protection, have morphed into this tool of political influence and potentially unconstitutional executive power, creating systemic risks that could be exploited by future administrations for entirely different agendas.
Exactly. If national accounting statistics can unlock such broad presidential powers, what dangerous precedent does this set? Pino speculates, for example, could a future Democratic president declare income inequality a national emergency and impose wealth taxes based on that? He suggests there's far more economic research backing up claims that income inequality is harmful than there is for the trade deficit being an emergency. This kind of power grab, regardless of party, has systemic risks that really threaten the rule of law itself.
Furthermore, these tariffs are having a tangible impact at the state level, not just on national policy.
Right. It's not just theoretical.
The article cites a report by the National Association of State Budget Officers. Many states have revised their revenue estimates downward for fiscal year 2026, partly due to Trump's tariffs.
How does that work?
Slower economic growth hurts state revenue, reduces profits, impacting corporate taxes, reduces jobs and wage growth, impacting income taxes, reduces consumption, impacting sales taxes.
Okay, hits them on multiple fronts.
And the states most affected, Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, where imports are a higher share of GDP. They're all states Trump won in 2024, largely Republican-controlled.
Ah, so it could hurt his own base politically.
Potentially. It could derail scheduled income tax cuts in these red states, leading to tougher budget choices for Republican legislators, impacting their ability to deliver on campaign promises.
And the foreign policy damage is equally striking, isn't it? Pino points out the inconsistency, the apparent capriciousness.
Yeah, give me an example.
India, a key strategic partner, faces a 50% tariff. That includes an extra 25% as punishment for buying Russian oil. This is significantly higher than China's 30% rate, despite China buying more Russian oil.
That doesn't seem logical.
Not based on the stated rationale. Meanwhile, Pakistan faces only a 19% tariff, seemingly due to flattery, like nominating Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize, despite its strong ties to China and being a major arms recipient from Beijing.
Flattery gets you lower tariffs.
Apparently. Then there's Brazil. They actually have a trade surplus with the U.S., yet face high tariffs because Trump is reportedly angry about how the country's political system is treating former President Jair Bolsonaro.
So personal grievances, not trade deficits.
These decisions seem utterly disconnected from national security or trade deficit concerns, driven instead by personal relationships, political grievances, rather than a coherent strategic vision.
This raises an important question. How do these tariff policies, driven by this mix of economic and political motivations, undermine the rule of law, impact the economy at both federal and state levels, and complicate international relations, especially with key partners like India?
Yeah, it seems to erode predictability, consistency in global trade and diplomacy, fosters an environment of uncertainty.
What's fascinating here is how the article highlights Trump's reaction to dissenting economic voices, firing Erica McEntarfer, the BLS commissioner, after a jobs report he disliked, clashing with Fed Chair Jerome Powell over interest rates.
Right, the pattern of dismissing bad news as fake when it doesn't align with his narrative.
It's a significant warning sign, as even private economists who notice the ill effects of his policies seem to incur his wrath.
The article stresses that these warning signs from diverse sources, different government branches, private economists, they should be paid attention to rather than just dismissed as inconvenient truths.
Okay, moving on to another critical geopolitical topic, one that often gets overlooked amidst other global crises. We have The Kashmir Conundrum, Why the U.S. Should Support India by Clifford Smith. This article quickly reminds us that while Kashmir often gets overshadowed, it's an ongoing India-Pakistan conflict with significant strategic implications, especially concerning China's growing influence.
Right. Historically, the territory has been divided. India controls about 55%, Pakistan 30%, and China took 15% after the 1962 Sino-Indian War. It's a complex, long-standing flashpoint.
And what's fascinating here is the article's recounting of recent events that really underscore the urgency and volatility.
Yeah, that Pahalgam attack.
Last April, that grisly terrorist attack in Pahalgam, Kashmir, killed 26 people, mostly Hindu tourists, claimed by the resistance front, which is closely linked to Pakistan's notorious ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence.
And India's response.
India's retaliatory operation Sindoor struck deep into Pakistan, significantly damaged terrorist infrastructure. And as an Indian think tank director observed, it exposed the poor quality of Chinese weapons that Pakistan relies on.
Ouch. So a military and a PR blow.
Pretty much. It was a bold move, effectively calling out Pakistan's nuclear bluff. Indian intelligence believes that bluff is a calculated move aimed at the U.S., unlikely to lead to actual nuclear escalation by Pakistan's military leadership.
Yeah.
It showed India's willingness to act decisively.
The article also discusses Modi's 2019 abrogation of Article 370. That removed Kashmir's special status, integrating it more fully into India.
Right, that caused a stir internationally.
It did generate international concern over human rights internet cutoffs, increased security forces. But, the article argues, it led to a period of calm and attracted significant investment, like $60 million from the UAE. India seems to believe this move helped curb terrorism by removing that ambiguity about Kashmir's future.
And in stark contrast, the article exposes Pakistan's chronic double dealing.
Seems to be a theme.
Abdul Rauf Azar, a U.S. designated terrorist linked to Jaish-e Mohammed, traveled freely in Pakistan. Pakistan, despite being a major non-NATO ally, receiving billions from the U.S., consistently undermines U.S. interests through deepening ties with China and the Taliban.
It paints a chilling picture of a relationship built on mutual disappointment, as the article puts it, where U.S. aid often seems to buy very little loyalty or strategic alignment.
And this leads to the pervasive genocide narrative that's actively promoted by Islamist networks like Jamaat Islami, ICNA, and these shadowy organizations like Stand With Kashmir.
How does that work?
These groups, often funded by the Pakistani government through channels like Syed Ghulam Nabi Faye, actively disseminate this Pakistani-friendly, anti-Indian picture of the Kashmir dispute, framing Indian actions as genocidal.
And this narrative gets traction.
It has even influenced U.S. figures. Representative Ilhan Omar is mentioned, who apparently derided a Kashmiri Pandit witness challenging it and later traveled to Pakistan-controlled Kashmir, lending credence to the Pakistani narrative.
Mm-hmm.
The article also highlights problematic external actors. Turkey and Qatar promoting the Pakistani line and Indian Islamists. Iran's ambitions in Shiite-heavy Kashmir. It's a complex web of ideological warfare where narratives are almost as important as military moves.
Which highlights the current U.S. policy dilemma, right? Moving closer to India, a pluralistic democracy concerned about China, radical Islam, while simultaneously maintaining ties with Pakistan, a state that actively undermines U.S. interests and harbors terrorists.
Yeah, it's a tough balancing act.
The article critiques Trump's misguided tactics, like those high tariffs on India for buying Russian oil. It points out India was slowly moving away from Russia, and such public humiliation only creates backlash, pushes them away.
Right. Counterproductive.
And the article argues America's relationship with terrorist-coddling Pakistan is equally galling to India and needs a reassessment. The core insight here is that the U.S. straddle policy on Kashmir, its continued enablement of Pakistan, is actively undermining its strategic alignment with India, a vital democratic partner against rising Chinese influence and radical Islam.
So the article outlines a clear proposed pro-India policy shift, argues for a decisive move away from the current ambiguity.
Right. First, it suggests holding Pakistan more rigorously accountable. Faster terror designations mirroring India's, re-adding Pakistan to the FATF's terror finance gray list, that global watch list.
Okay, more accountability. What else?
Second, recognizing the ethnic cleansing of Kashmiri Hindus to restore truth and help bridge communal divides, acknowledging a historical injustice.
That's a strong statement.
And finally, it argues the U.S. straddle on Kashmir should end by officially recognizing Indian-controlled areas as Indian territory, not disputed territory.
Wow. That would be a significant change from the current State Department position, a powerful diplomatic signal.
It would directly counter Pakistan's two-nation theory justification for its claim to Muslim-majority Kashmir.
So weighing the costs and benefits of such a dramatic shift, the article concludes the Pakistani-U.S. relationship is often characterized by mutual disappointment, suggesting there's less to be lost than meets the eye.
Especially given intelligence reports that Pakistan is reportedly building an ICBM that could reach the U.S.
So given this complex web of alliances, ideological warfare, how should the U.S. navigate the Kashmir conundrum to best serve its long-term strategic interests? What are the consequences of continuing this straddle policy? Is sticking to the old playbook really the safest option anymore?
Well, the strategic interests for the U.S. clearly lean towards strengthening ties with India as that crucial counterbalance to China and radical Islam in the region. Continuing the straddle policy risks alienating India, maybe pushing it closer to rivals like Russia, and implicitly condoning Pakistan's destabilizing actions.
So inaction has consequences too.
Definitely. By failing to hold Pakistan accountable and refusing to recognize Indian Kashmir as Indian territory, the U.S. inadvertently validates that two-nation theory promoted by Pakistan's military, which just fuels the conflict, undermines regional stability, the potential consequences of maintaining the status quo. A weakened relationship with a rising democratic power, continued instability in a nuclear-armed region, a less credible stance against terrorism.
So the argument is for a decisive shift.
A decisive pro-India shift, yes.
Yeah.
While it might incur short-term diplomatic friction with Pakistan, it aligns more closely with long-term U.S. values and strategic objectives. It acknowledges that Pakistan's current trajectory, influenced by figures like Army Chief Asim Munir, is fundamentally at odds with American interests. The article strongly implies the relationship with Pakistan has become more of a liability than an asset.
A pragmatic call for reevaluation, not an emotional one.
Exactly.
Now, let's pivot to some rapid-fire, engaging discussions on selected high-interest topics from the week and department sections. Because National Review is always full of those surprising little nuggets that offer unique insights into our cultural currents and everyday realities. These are quicker takes, but no less thought-provoking.
First up, AI policy and vaccine technology, two very different sides of innovation. The White House has launched an AI action plan. Trump's words prohibits the federal government from buying any AI product infused with partisan bias or ideological agendas.
Okay.
It also aims to expedite construction of all major AI infrastructure projects by waiving Biden-era environmental obstacles, ease federal regulatory burdens, and encourage export of American hardware and software to maintain American leadership.
So a big push for American AI dominance.
Seems like it. These policies are within the federal government's remit, welcomed on their merits, with the explicit goal of America winning the global AI race by accelerating development and deployment.
And in stark contrast to that embrace of cutting-edge tech, we have Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announcing that HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, has canceled $500 million in grants for mRNA vaccine technology.
Canceled? Where's the money going?
Redirected to more traditional vaccine platforms.
Mm.
What's important to understand here is the incredible potential of mRNA tech. It can instruct human cells to produce harmless viral fragments, training the immune system. Many scientists believe the next generation of cancer treatments will be mRNA-based, attacking a patient's specific cancer cells, truly personalized medicine.
But Kennedy claims they're ineffective.
His claims are weak at best, according to the article. The mRNA COVID vaccines were more effective at preventing infection, symptoms, hospitalization than non-mRNA competitors, and they can be rapidly updated for new variants. So this decision pulls back from a really promising, rapidly evolving field based on what many see as, well, questionable science.
So it's fascinating to consider how these two distinct policy decisions, one enthusiastically embracing and accelerating AI, the other pulling back from a revolutionary platform like mRNA, reflect very different philosophies of innovation and government's role.
Yeah.
What are the potential long-term impacts of these contrasting approaches on American competitiveness and public health? It's a real fork in the road, isn't it?
It really highlights a tension between proactive national strategy and a more cautious, maybe even skeptical, approach to new technologies. Trump's AI plan is strategic, almost industrial policy-like. A push to ensure American leadership, recognizing AI as critical, accelerating progress, removing obstacles.
And Kennedy's.
Kennedy's decision reflects a distrust of novel biotechnologies, opting for traditional methods, possibly driven by a more cautious, maybe anti-establishment philosophy. The long-term impact. Embracing AI likely keeps the U.S. at the forefront. Pulling back from mRNA risks ceding leadership in a field with immense potential for future pandemics, diseases like cancer.
Making the U.S. less prepared, potentially reliant on other nations.
Could be. It's a fundamental divergence on how best to secure the nation's future.
Okay, let's move to another key topic. The battle over representation. Specifically, gerrymandering and the Voting Rights Act. The issue highlights the political hardball of redrawing congressional maps. Texas Republicans pushing to redraw theirs for 2026.
Which, of course, elicits counter threats from Democrats like Newsom in California, Pritzker in Illinois.
But the article points out Democrats are hardly innocent here. They also engage in heavy gerrymandering. Cites California's 43-9 Democratic delegation from 58.4% of the vote, Illinois' 14-3 Democratic edge from 52.8%. It's a practice both parties engage in to maximize power, leveraging geography and demographics.
And speaking of gerrymandering, the Supreme Court is currently re-examining Louisiana v. Calais. This case involves a second majority black congressional district drawn explicitly on racial grounds after lower courts threw out a map with only one such district.
Okay, so race-based districting.
Exactly. Justice Brett Kavanaugh is highlighted as the key justice to watch. While he's previously balked at fully reconsidering how the court reads Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, he also wrote in 2023 that the authority to conduct race-based redistricting cannot extend indefinitely into the future.
Hmm. Interesting nuance there.
The core question the court is considering is whether VRA precedents are pushing states to segregate voters by race in ways that are unconstitutional. The article provocatively asks, is 43 years of race-based redistricting enough to remedy historical disenfranchisement?
So, in light of both parties' gerrymandering practices and the Supreme Court's re-examination of Section 2, what does this ongoing debate mean for the future of fair and representative elections?
Yeah, what's the bottom line?
This case could fundamentally redefine fair representation. If the court curtails race-based districts, we'll see a shift in how political power is consolidated. It might force parties to fight for broader appeal rather than relying on carved-out safe seats. It really challenges the very definition of electoral fairness. #tax# A Thought for Your Pennies by Joseph Epstein, Happy Warrior column.
Let's move to something a little lighter, or perhaps a little more nostalgic. In Joseph Epstein's Happy Warrior column titled A Thought for Your Pennies, we learn about the Treasury Department's decision to cease penny production early next year.
No more pennies.
Apparently.
Yeah.
The reason is purely economic. Cost 3.69 cents to make each one. Ending production saves an estimated $56 million. Pennies, the article notes, are simply falling out of use, often just tossed aside. They'll remain legal tender, but availability will slowly decline. Even Elon Musk and President Trump were apparently in favor of ditching the penny.
But Joseph Epstein, a figure of considerably less power, he's certainly not in favor. He laments the potential loss of many congenial phrases from our lexicon. Imagine. A nickel for your thoughts. Doesn't work. A dime saved is a dime earned. Nope.
Ha. Yeah, the rhythm is off.
Girls named Penelope might no longer be called Penny. We'd lose songs like Bing Crosby's Pennies from Heaven.
Yeah.
Beyond phrases, he recalls deeply personal connections, buying penny candy, licorice whips, wax lips at the local school store as a kid, a small ritual of childhood.
Oh, yeah, and candy.
He also notes his own habit of saving coins, including pennies, accumulating over $1,000 he dreams of spending on something extravagant, like a rare tortoise or cashmere underwear.
Cashmere underwear, okay. It's a very human connection to a seemingly insignificant coin.
Epstein's concern, however, goes deeper than just nostalgia or a few lost phrases. He suspects that dispensing with the penny may well be the first step toward getting rid of cash in the United States entirely.
The cashless society argument.
Exactly. He observes the growing trend of restaurants, shops, gas stations that no longer accept cash. Customers increasingly paying via smartphones. Cash payment, he notes, is already a minority practice. He predicts the nickel will go next, then the dime and quarter, leading us toward a cashless society where everyone pays by aiming their phone. He even brings up W.H. Auden, who carried $5 so as not to disappoint a potential mugger. For Epstein, without cash paper bills, coins, yes, even lowly pennies, we are somehow all much the poorer.
This raises an important point for us to ponder, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is phasing out the penny a practical necessity in a modern, increasingly digital economy?
Or
is it a symbolic loss hinting at a broader, perhaps unsettling, shift towards a cashless society? And what are the deeper, maybe unseen, cultural and personal consequences of losing the tangibility of money?
It's a fascinating thought experiment. On one hand, the practicality is undeniable. Producing a penny costs more than its face value. Many people just ignore them. Streamlining transactions, reducing costs seems rational.
But on the other hand?
On the other hand, Epstein's lament taps into something deeper. Money isn't just a medium of exchange. It has cultural resonance, personal history, symbolic weight.
Right.
A cashless society, while efficient, could erode privacy. Every transaction digitally recorded, creating a detailed ledger of our lives.
Could marginalize those without bank accounts or digital literacy.
Definitely. And on a more subtle level, it might diminish our connection to the physical economy, to the small, tangible acts of commerce. What do we lose when money becomes entirely abstract, purely a number on a screen, detached from the weight and feel of a coin in our hand?
It's not just about savings or efficiency, is it? It's about a piece of our daily lives, our language, even our sense of independence in a world increasingly monitored and mediated by technology. #tagoutro.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into the October 2025 issue of National Review. What an incredible journey it's been, one that has consistently forced us to question conventional wisdom. We've dissected the surprising successes of education reform in southern states, the nuanced expanding battle for parental rights.
Grappled with the hidden damages of economic policy, shifting geopolitical alignments.
And even contemplated the subtle cultural shifts hinted at by the fate of the humble penny. This issue truly spans the breadth and depth of critical debates shaping our nation, revealing how many of our long-held assumptions are being profoundly reevaluated.
It absolutely does, and I hope this deep dive has been invaluable for you in gaining critical insights, appreciating the multiple perspectives on these complex issues. As we've seen, being well-informed isn't just about skimming headlines. It's about understanding the underlying arguments, the data, the historical context, and the profound implications of these developments for our society, our future.
Yeah.
It's about engaging with the reset that is happening all around us, whether we actively observe it or not.
So, as we've explored the diverse discussions within this issue, from that surprising success in Southern schools to the far-reaching impact of tariffs, and, yes, even the fate of the humble penny, it becomes clear that many of our societal narratives and institutions are undergoing profound reevaluation. What responsibility do you believe we have as citizens to actively engage with these debates and question the assumptions that shape our collective future, rather than just passively observing the reset unfolding around us?